Welcome to Head Start, the podcast for race directors and the business of putting on races. Securing sponsorship is undoubtedly one of the toughest jobs on any race director's plate, and finding and approaching sponsors in particular is probably the toughest bit of it. Where do you even begin looking for good sponsor prospects? How do you know which person to contact? What do sponsors really want, and how do you make that first approach to maximize your chances of success? Well, we've got some awesome tips for you on all those burning questions and more from today's guest, Teresa Stas. Teresa is the CEO of event sponsorship consultancy, Green Cactus. She's also the author of Sell Your Event, the easy-to-follow practical guide to getting sponsors, and she has spent her entire career helping events of all shapes and sizes land long-term sponsorship relationships, including Hood to Coast, the world's largest relay race, now also a growing international relay race franchise. So, if you're struggling for traction in your sponsorship efforts, stick around for some great pearls of wisdom from Teresa over the next hour and a half or so. I should say that you may notice a couple of audio glitches in today's episode, which unfortunately we couldn't edit out of it. I hope it doesn't spoil your enjoyment of the episode too much, and I do apologize for those. We had some small technical issues during that recording. Last thing, before we dive into this awesome episode, a quick shout out to the amazing sponsors supporting this podcast. Many thanks to Run Signup, Race Director's favorite all-in-one technology solution for endurance and fundraising events, now powering more than 26,000 in-person, virtual, and hybrid events. And many thanks to RaceCheck, whose free RaceCheck review box widget can help you collect and showcase your participant feedback on your own website, helping you more easily convert website visitors into paying participants. We'll be hearing a bit more from these two great companies a little later in the podcast, but now let's dive into finding and approaching sponsors with Teresa Stas. Teresa, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. We're going to be talking about sponsorship today, which is always a very exciting topic for race directors. Before we go into that, though, let's start with some introductions. So would you please tell us a little bit about yourself, your company, Green Cactus, and the work you do for events?
Yes, of course. My name is Teresa Stas, and I am the CEO of Green Cactus, which is a sponsorship agency, and we're based out of California here in the U.S., as well as Portland, Oregon. So we specialize in a lot of events West Coast-based, but I also have authored a couple of books about sponsorships, and then I do articles for International Festival and Events Association, as well as other programs, but we are kind of twofold. So one is we do brokering and actually handle all the sponsorship management, both prelim and then on site. And that's one of our specialties. And then our other, of course, is education. So it's very important coming from the world of smaller events originally before I launched into more mega event style now. But coming from that world, I found that it was very difficult for smaller and mid-size events to get any real help when it came to sponsorships, and all the books and everything that were written for it are for what you would call rights holders, but they're like either venues or events that are very, very big. And that when I was first starting off, it was very hard to find information on how to do sponsorships when you were a smaller one. So we specialize in educating small events, as well as consulting with them and working on their sponsorship program. But then we also broker and deal with sponsorships on a regular basis. And those are normally for very large events, including one of our big events that's very relevant to you guys, which is Hood to Coast Race Series, which one of the most popular relay races in the world. And it's been franchised in like four different countries, has multiple series. And we're really proud of it. It's coming up really, really soon. But it's a 200-mile relay race going from Mount Hood to Seaside, Oregon.
Yeah, what an amazing event. So basically, you do sponsorship sales for Hood to Coast, sort of like the whole 360, right?
Yes, yes.
But then, as you also said, you also then take some of those things you learn from that and some of the sort of like the playbook and some of the strategy, and you also put it into your consulting work, which is educating others how to basically learn how to do sponsorship and sort of like smaller and medium events can get out there and do it for themselves.
Exactly. Yes. Because most people will find we get calls. We probably get 10 to 20 calls a week, events wanting our services. And to be quite frank, for most brokers, because they work off commission, smaller events just don't earn enough to be worth it to a lot of brokers. So little newsflash there. If you get one that says that they want to do it on commission only, be leery. But yeah, so for us, it's more about teaching them how to do it themselves and in a profitable way, and also being able to take all of their money instead of forking over some of it to commission.
Okay, awesome. I guess some of the stuff we'll be going through today is based on that consulting work and all of that advice that you have accumulated for smaller events.
Yes, absolutely. We have a book as well as a workbook that they kind of work together. And so some of the stuff that we're going to be kind of going through and everything is all kinds of things that you can find in there, but it is all doable stuff, and it's stuff that events can do for themselves.
Awesome. So today we've been going a little bit back and forth on this. I was trying to find what the best area within sponsorship would be to discuss. And I think we agreed that the prospecting stage, which is how you find sponsors, and then sort of the approach stage, which is how you actually do the first reach out, is going to be quite important. But as you were telling me the other day, and I think it's quite helpful for the context of today's episode, we may want to start a little bit before that. A little bit before the prospecting phase, because lots of what happens in the prospecting phase starts a little bit earlier than that. And you suggested that we start by discussing how rights holders, that's race directors, event directors, can get a better understanding of their audience. And I took a note when we were talking on the phone, because you said something I've actually put down in a quote, which is, you said, when you're selling sponsorship, you're selling an audience. So do you want to elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, it's probably the very first thing that I always tell everybody when I speak, and also when I do any kind of training, is there's this misconception that people are selling their event. And the truth is you're selling the audience. You're not selling your event. Most of the time when I talk to sponsors, the event is sort of peripheral, which is kind of interesting because you spend so much time and effort putting it together. But if you have no audience, then you really have no event. It's kind of like if you put on the exact same Coachella, but nobody was there, then the value of Coachella is gone. So you have to know the audience, and the audience is what the sponsors are targeting. So those events, when we start working with them, the first thing we ask them is, what do you know about your audience? What is it that you know? And how can we use that information to lead us the correct sponsors? And you would be surprised at how little they know about who they're actually targeting. Or what happens is they self-identify to their audience, which isn't necessarily true. So they believe that they are the audience because they're putting the event together, which is not a lot of times not the truth. So I can't tell you how many country music festivals we work on here in the US. And I am not really what you would call a country music fan. You can't relate it to yourself. You can't say, well, that's what I would want. I mean, you sure you can think about it that way, but you have to be very cognizant of who your actual audience, who is actually attending your event, who is actually racing your race, and what their lifestyle is like. Once you understand that, then it becomes a lot easier to sell sponsorships. A lot of times events completely skip over that factor, and that is actually what your sponsor is buying. So if you don't understand that, then you are just wasting your time.
Yeah. So in a sense, you're saying you need to understand the product, right? Because that audience is what you're going to sponsors with.
Yes, exactly. You could have the most amazing race, but if you don't know who your audience is, then it means nothing to those sponsors. And that's the biggest thing I find with smaller events, is they just don't know.
And in the context of a race, who would be making up that audience? Are we talking the people taking part in the race? Are we talking the people coming out to cheer for them? Are we talking even like remote people following my Facebook page? Who exactly is that audience?
Well, it's interesting. That's a fantastic question. And I don't get it very often. That's a great thing to understand about how you can segment that audience too. for me, I would say your audience is anybody you're specifically trying to target. Now, if you find out, like I'll use Hood to Coast as an example, they have about, it's somewhere in their neighborhood of 30,000 runners. And then they also have a waiting list of 30,000 people who are just trying to get into this race. And then, but the funny thing is their beach party or the finish line tends to have a close to 80 to 100,000 people that are there. Well, obviously they're not all runners. So having an understanding of who those mixed runners versus is fantastic because it opens your sponsorship spectrum as well. If you have an event that has, and let me say, that is not common. So we do understand that a lot of events don't have like the same amount in attendees supporting as they do in runners. I get that. But us understanding that has made it changes the way we sell because we do know that a lot of the general public is coming to that event. So it doesn't necessarily always have to be race based. So some of the products that are out there are, we have cocktails and we have, you know, beer and things like that. And then at one point we realized there were so many dogs coming out to this event that maybe it's worth going after chew toys or things like that, because obviously this audience was bringing all their dogs out to the beach as well. So you should be cognizant of who those are, but you should also understand who your primary audience is. Well, obviously for this event, the primary audience is going to be the runners, like most of your events are, because that's where the bulk of your people are. Now, if you maybe it's like a race, or just for lack of better examples, like the Olympics or something, the amount of runners in comparison to those watching is a totally different thing. It's flipped. So you would say that you have a segmented sponsored that's going to go to the runners. You're targeting those. Your brand is targeting those runners, or you're going to have the one that's going to target the audience that's watching it. So the good thing to think about this is look at it and say to yourself, do I have multiple audiences? Do I have a viewership versus a running, you know, I'm just dealing with the running community. So that's a great way to look at it. And a lot of people miss that completely. And the other thing too, is sometimes with events, the B2B aspect is something that people miss as well. And this isn't quite the same thing, but like we're dealing with a brew festival out of Miami and there's 50 craft brewers that are there. Now, obviously the large audience is going to be all those people attending the brew festival, but there's 50 brewers there. So there are certain programs or technology or things like that that are interested in looking at this event because they want to target the 50 brewers. So knowing who those different segments are is a huge way of looking at sponsorships that a lot of events miss. And so I'm glad you brought that up because honestly, a lot of people don't ask me who the audience is. They automatically assume it's going to be the runners, which yes, of course it is. But look at those different segments and see if they're worth capturing or if you can target different sponsors because of them.
There doesn't seem to be a cookie cutter way of looking at this.
Correct.
It probably needs a little bit of thinking through this a little bit to pick up on all the different opportunities for sponsorship.
Yes. And I think that that is why, honestly, why runs struggle some on their sponsorships unless they're at a certain size, like your midsize or your community runs or things like that. Sometimes will struggle a little bit is because in my experience, they all want to work the same way. They all want to do it the same way. They want to do the levels. They want to do like, and the thing is that you cannot do that. And if you look at the way really big events work is they go to their uniqueness, they go in and directly figure out who all these different pieces are. That's why they're making all the money. And people want to say, well, they're making all of it because they have so many people. Well, yes, that's an element of it. But just having a giant audience and not knowing anything about them doesn't, nobody wants to buy that. They'd rather buy an event that has 100 people and they know 90% of that 100 people want to buy a car, versus having a mass group of, oh, I've got an audience of 10,000, but I don't know anything about them. I mean, because at least this small group is a guarantee. So I think some smaller events, and I know the problem is that most of them run on very small staffs or volunteers and things like that. But if they want to go in and make more money, and this is across the board too. This is with larger events. We work with a lot of larger events, and some of them are missing the boat on this too. But you have to really understand your event and not try to do it like everybody else, and take those tools and understand your audience and figure out how you can segment it and go in that direction. But it is a case by case basis. I wish I could say like, this is how you do it. There is an overall process, and you can apply that process to almost any event, but the different pieces are very customized, but that's what's going to make your event special. And that's why somebody would buy your event over somebody else's.
In terms of the actual information that I should look to mine about my audience that a sponsor would be interested in, there's the standard stuff like, you know, like gender, age, location, maybe income. What else would be relevant for me to think through getting for my audience so I can be prepared in talking to sponsors?
You're absolutely correct that, you know, at the very minimum, you want to try and get at least the most basic demographic information from your event: education, income, age, race, gender, all that kind of stuff. That's all very pertinent information. Most of our national brands that we work with won't even look at an event until I at least have those basic things provided for them. The next step is what we call lifestyle traits or lifestyle attributes that are tied to these people that are participating. And that involves, I mean, to really think about the categories that you can target. So we try to find out things like, do you travel for leisure? Do you travel multiple times a year, or only maybe once or twice, or not at all? What's your job title? What kind of levels are there? Because there are special brands that will target CEOs or certain C-level participants. Where do they shop? Do they shop online? If they are online, what kind of social media channels do they use? The other thing is things like beverages, like, you know, do you drink alcohol? Do you drink beer? Do you drink sodas? Beverages, a huge, huge sponsorship category. It's probably our number one. Almost every one of our events, we can sell in beverages. So that's a great one to know. Things like what they do in their spare time, kind of hobbies, things like that. Wearables is a great one for racing. Wearables is a huge category, and understanding what your audience wears and how they use it is also a great way. And I actually have a good example of that with Hood to Coast. We sent out a lifestyle survey. It was only 20 questions, multiple choice. I always tell everybody, try to make it multiple choice. Don't make it any more than 20 questions, and try to do an incentive when you do this. And you can send it out to the emails or try to have them do it when they're there. If it's multiple choice, you get a lot faster responses. But honestly, it was an event. I mean, the event is in Portland. It's a pretty affluent group that participates in this race because it's not cheap. It's about $1,600. So for a lot of racers, that's kind of expensive, plus you have to travel and have vans and all that kind of stuff. So,
well, we should just say on that, just so people get a bit of context, it's a relay race, right? It's a team price.
Yes, it's a team price. Correct. Yes. But it is still high. You have to get it together. You have to pay the whole thing at once, you know, so it can be a little challenging. And then there's the other expenses like vans and things like that. For us, we thought, okay, Portland, Oregon, kind of affluent, very healthy health nuts, you know, that kind of thing. They're going to be into plant-based proteins. Like, we totally thought that that was going to be a hit. So when we sent out our lifestyle survey, we included a bunch of stuff, but one of the things we also included was wearables. And then we talked about plant-based proteins, if they were interested in that. And surprisingly, it came back like 1% was interested in plant-based proteins. I was completely stunned. I thought it would be way higher than that, especially since there's a lot of vegetarians in that particular area, but the runners that participated in this race were not that interested in it. But on the flip side, we found out about a watch company that about 25% of the runners were already using that we had not even heard of. And so we used that information, approached that company and said, I mean, the audience told us who to go to. And so we approached them and said, look, 25% of our runners are using your watch for long distance running and training. Would, you know, do you have an interest in approaching, really marketing towards these other runners as well, or upgrading those that are, and they were totally on board. And I would not even known, and I'm in this industry, and would not have known to even look at that particular brand. my audience told me, stay away from plant-based protein and go towards this wearable. The other thing we learned is about how much they travel. So if they travel a lot, then you can start targeting vacations or airlines or rental cars or things like that, or hotel companies, those kinds of things. So understanding that information is huge when it comes to the world of prospecting, and people forget all of that. And then they just start calling people randomly and you're just wasting your time at that point.
It sounds like what you're saying is, think a little bit ahead to the kinds of sponsors that you think might be interested in the kind of audience you have, say the wearables, the sports watches, the running shoes, the hotels, if you're looking for like to have like an official hotel or something, and then a little bit like work backwards to gather that information that the sponsor would be interested in on top of the usual demographic stuff. Is that sort of how you approach things?
Yes, I would say for me, we do kind of work a little backwards, but we have a lot of knowledge in that. I know that some people don't. There are standard survey questions. We even have one in our workbook that people can start with until they start to sort of feel where they're going with this. But if you've been doing your event for a while, you kind of have you should have an understanding of this audience. You should have an understanding of kind of what's out there as far as sponsorships. Being able to do those surveys will help guide you to that deal. And some of these questions are a little general. And then you know, things like, how do you prefer your information on social media? Do you like them in reels? Do you like them in stories? You know, things like that. Those questions can also help with your marketing in a huge way too. Once you understand, you know, how your audience gets their consumption, it really helps with your marketing. Sponsorships and marketing go hand in hand in a lot of ways. But yes, I think you're right in the backwards notion, but sometimes people have no idea even where to start. And in that sense, doing some basic standard ones like travel, vehicles, beverages, you know, those are standard categories that, you know, you can find money in. So getting a sense of where to go within those categories is very helpful.
And vehicles, actually, it's a particularly interesting one. I keep seeing not only actual car manufacturers being involved, but very much in the US, local dealerships, lots of them going in, particularly for smaller events with cash. They want to have a presence. They want to bring a car out. And they're very specific about the data they want to know about people participating. Do they own a car? What kind of car? Would they buy a car? That kind of stuff, I guess, if you can get it from people, because you can't be asking 60 questions as well.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why you do sort of a general 20 question. And sometimes, you know, some of our bigger events will even send these surveys out once every 3 months, 4 months, you know, you don't want to do it too often. But if you provide sort of an incentive or a prize, or maybe even it's like an early discount or something like that, you usually get a pretty good rate. People don't mind telling you about themselves, especially if you make it really quick and easy. And that you can kind of hone in and cultivate. So if you think you've got a couple of ideas in a certain category, then you can put something together and send it out there. And it can be very helpful, but especially with dealerships is, especially in the US, it's a major category, both national brand and then also local dealerships. There's a lot of money in both ways, and they're trying very hard to get into that. So like I said, even if you have a smaller event, if you know that 20% or 30% of that event, even if it's smaller, want to buy a car within the next 6 months, then that is going to be a very valuable tool to those local dealerships. You might not get the national, but the local will, versus one where you're like, I have a really big audience, I just don't know anything about them.
The race survey, as you said, is one tool for getting information back from people. And the tip you shared there about including an incentive definitely helps. But then there's other channels, right? And there's also things you can do to understand your audience without even involving your audience directly or intruding in their space.
Absolutely.
There's Facebook Insights, I think you were discussing in your book, which is very helpful. Google Analytics, I guess. Also, if you have website visitors, we'll tell you a little bit about that stuff. Do you want to tell people a little bit about, I think Facebook Insights particularly is an interesting one.
Yeah, so both. And so same thing with Instagram, and now that they're owned by the same company, you have to be somewhat understanding of the fact that those that may follow your page might not necessarily be participants. But if you have a good general following in your social media, or you have a nice email list, those are the kinds of analytics and a good website, things like that. You can look at those insights and they can actually tell you what kinds of groups that your audience are involved in, what kinds of things they tend to like. And you can really kind of take a deep dive in, getting a sense of at least your online audience, which will give you some place to start. And I always tell events, especially if they're really new or they absolutely have no real insight into their audience, that's the first thing. That's one of the first places to start is go ahead and look into your social media analytics and your insights, because both Instagram and as well as Facebook have actually a pretty damn good breakout of what your audience is. I mean, take some time and actually click on the people that like it and see what their pages look like and what they're into. And, you know, you get kind of a good sense of where you're at with those people. It's the same thing with your website, Google Analytics. If you have a decent website and you are driving traffic to it, you can get some really good information on that as well. So these are things that are tools that you can, that give you a really great starting point. I still don't think there's anything better than the actual survey of your audience. But the one thing that races have that a lot of other events don't have is, because the information you have to have in order to be a participant in the race, you guys pretty much come out with most of the basic info already. And when you have them register, you could put in one or two extra questions in that registration if you want to. Maybe they don't have to answer it, but maybe it is like, hey, do you want to buy a car in the next 6 months? Or what kind of social media platforms do you tend to follow, or things like that? So you could throw a couple more in there and it would help a lot. The other thing that's really interesting too is now a lot of those ticketing platforms and registration platforms can tie into social media, so people can easily log in using their social media. When you use something like that tool, it also captures all that data for you in a very easy way, where you get a lot more insight than you would necessarily with just a name and email address. So, I mean, a lot of that is trial and error, but those are really great tools that you can use.
Yeah. And I think actually the tip with regards to the registration checkout flow is really important for people, right? I mean, you have an opportunity when someone signs up, as you say, you're not going to make the process too long, because then you have other kinds of risks, right? But you can add a couple of questions, right? You can ask things that maybe a local gym might be interested in knowing, you know, like, do you exercise often, right? Or the travel point that you ask.
Or what kind of watch you use or shoe you use or whatever.
Yeah. Plus the other question that I find also when you apply for permits, people would be interested in knowing, local authorities, which is, particularly if you're traveling to the race from out of town, is how many people are you bringing with you, kind of thing, right? That's also important information to capture.
Yeah, that is like an impact study information, which is also very important. But I do want to make a distinction about that, because I do sometimes, what will happen is when I start with an event, they say, oh yeah, we have all this information about the audience, and what they have is an impact study about the impact it has on those communities, which doesn't really help you sell anything overall. It's great for tourism. It's great to know for if you're trying to get, you know, funding from the cities or the states, but they don't help as much when it comes to selling. So just keep that in mind, that when you're out there and you're like, oh, I've got this information, make sure what you have is not an impact study, but you have like a real demographics of your audience as well as lifestyle information.
Yeah, absolutely. So one last question I had on audiences, I think it was in your book, and I've seen it elsewhere, people also in marketing, they use personas, right? So basically you understand your audience to the point where you actually build a little kind of like caricature of your typical person in your audience.
Like an avatar.
An avatar, yeah. And you say, like, you know, like, that's Jen, and she's 37 years old, and she's a mom, that kind of thing. Do you think that helps? Would you advise race directors to think through the process of building a persona?
I have sort of an activity in our workbook that you can do with your group. I think the reason why that helps is that if you have multiple people on your team, even if it's small or even if they're all volunteers, oftentimes there's a breakdown internally on who your audience is. Like, you know, you probably have different people that are in different types of demographics, or some are younger, some are older. And so what we do as humans is we self-identify. So, you know, Jenny, who's 20, is always thinking that the race participant is like her, but Bob, who's 40, thinks it's like him. And so sometimes there's a breakdown in who are we targeting here, or who is it that we're going after? And granted, especially with runs, any kind of like activity, there's going to be your core, and it's going to be probably pretty wide, especially with running. I mean, it can go a big, broad, but all of your runs are different in some capacity. Maybe it's a triathlon, maybe it's, you know, so there's something very, there's going to be different. So I have like an exercise in there that I try to suggest that people walk through, which is building that avatar, which is taking that basic information, that information that you've found about your demographic, and creating one. I mean, go as far as finding a picture online and putting her on there, and or putting her up in your office and saying, you know, this is Jenny, she's our core. And it's okay to have a couple of them too. I mean, there's a lot of events that have a couple of them. We have a sort of a large age round, especially when it comes to different music festivals, that happens as well. So, but having that, going through that process, also makes you look at something and say, okay, would Jenny go to this, you know, this particular sponsor, or would Jenny be interested in this particular wearable or whatever? And it kind of helps you narrow some of that wasted time down. At first, it seems a little like it might be a wasted project in sense, but you'd be surprised at how doing that really kind of brings the whole group to understand who the target is. And it is perfect for marketing. And it's a very common practice in marketing as well.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because personas, as you say, they do give off the impression that, you know, like, why would I do that? Of course, I know who my audience is, kind of thing. But I had Peter Abraham in the podcast, who's like a branding expert, a few episodes back. And we talked a lot about the importance of a mission statement. And that's another thing that you think you have one at the back of your mind. But, you know, like after that podcast, I actually sat down and I wrote a mission statement for Race Directors HQ, for instance. And it is remarkable how helpful these things are, personas and mission statement, in focusing you when you want to make a decision. Let's say you want to approach a sponsor. You need to ask yourself, is that the kind of product or service that Jen, our persona, would want us, you know, would be interested in us having in the race?
Absolutely. And having and knowing that, as well as with the mission statement too, is when you're sort of mid and smaller size, the idea of actually turning a sponsor away seems unfathomable. But once you start to understand who, what your brand is, what it stands for, those kinds of things, and who your audience is, there are times where you're like, yeah, I know this brand wants to give us money, but it really isn't a good fit. And that's the other thing that I find events doing, is they sort of will shove their event somehow, or shove the sponsor in somehow, because they don't want to turn the money down. But ultimately, it's a fail as far as the audience. You know, a really kind of a funny example of that is there's a huge EDM electric dance music festival in Miami, and we are not a part of this, but it's called Ultra, and it's huge. They have them internationally as well, probably one of the largest EDM festivals. But they decided to do, this is a few years back, decided to do one where Kentucky Fried Chicken, Colonel Sanders, became a hologram, and he DJed as a hologram. Okay. Now, as someone who's in sponsorships, I personally think it's genius. I thought that was, you know, hilarious. But the audience just like hated it. They thought they were making fun of the music. They thought that it was too commercialized. It was like they, you know, that you could bring this sort of caricature of a fast food restaurant and have him replicate all what these musicians and artists are doing. I mean, someone totally missed the boat on that, because they were trying to take a Kentucky Fried Chicken and force them into an EDM festival. Now, it's sort of funny. It's kind of comical. But it's a great example of someone missed the boat there, because they didn't really take into account, and they got a lot of pushback and flack for it. And it was not good for the sponsor either. So understanding what your mission is, understanding who your audience is, not only helps you in your decisions and sponsorships, but it's going to help you overall in the branding of your event. So taking the time to do that, because it can be hard. Mission statements can be really hard too, to kind of work together, especially if you're doing it with a group. I mean, that's the worst, but it's a little bit like this project too, can be a little bit daunting at the very beginning. But honestly, if you just say, okay, I'm going to give myself 2 hours, and we're all going to focus on this, then it will help you in the long term for sure.
When it comes to sponsorship, closing sponsors is only part of the job. Keeping them happy is where the real work begins. And fortunately for you, Run Signup, the trusted provider of all the technology you'll ever need for your event, has a few things up its sleeve to help you along the way. With Run Signup's sponsor management system, you can easily control how your sponsors are promoted through your race website and how they appear on your event emails. You can choose to send out to your participants dedicated emails on behalf of your sponsors with offers and other information, and even include watermarks of your sponsor brands on your race photos, which is a great way, by the way, to incentivize sponsors to pay for your free race photos if you choose to go down that road. You can also design custom email templates that nicely incorporate your sponsor branding and set up fully custom pages on your race website to share your sponsor's stories with your participants and website visitors. And when the time comes to put together a sponsorship proposal or send that next monthly update to your sponsors, Run Signup's data reporting tools can help you save tons of time collecting and compiling the data you need with instant data exports in all major data formats and great graph visualizations you can just copy and paste straight into your sponsor reports. So, to learn more about Run Signup's sponsor activation capabilities and many other great features, head over to runsignup.com. That's runsignup.com, and see why over 26,000 events are using Run Signup's industry-leading technology to take their races to the next level. Okay, now let's get back to the episode. Next thing, after understanding your audience or, you know, like gaining some of that data, what you advise people is to build an intro deck, an introduction deck for your event, which is not to say build a sponsorship proposal, right? These are two different things.
They are two different things. So the term intro deck is not super common in the industry, and they usually call it a deck. I named it an intro deck simply to make it very clear to my students and all the and those that I'm consulting that this is an introduction to your event. So the interesting thing is that a lot of events will create, like, they might have a couple of pages about all about the event. Maybe there's a whole history about the event, and then it's stapled to like five different levels, gold, silver, bronze, or whatever. And that is very common. And the problem with that scenario is that you have sent this to someone, and 90% of the time, I could be wrong, but 90% of the time, you've sent this to someone who A, didn't really ask for it. You don't even know if they're interested in your event. You, without even talking to them, you have decided for them what they're going to get, the price tag they're going to get, and you don't even know what their goal is. You don't even know what they're trying to get out of it. So what you've put together may have nothing to do with what they want to try to get out of sponsorship. So your cookie cutter, bronze, gold, silver, what happens is they look at it, they care, and they say, well, I don't need a Facebook mention. I don't want a logo. I don't want this, so I'm just not going to buy it. I compare it to walking into a dealership, and if you walked in and they said to you without asking you any questions, these are the three cars you can buy. You know, one is a convertible Mercedes that only holds two people. One is a 16-passenger van, and the other is, you know, like a Yaris or something. And none of them fit your price tag, and none of them fit your needs, which is a family of four. What do? Well, you just don't buy any of them. You just leave. And that's the same thing that's happening with these like levels and that kind of stuff. So the introduction deck, or what that is it's your, for me, I think of it as a way for them to see all of the relevant information that they need to see to make a decision on whether or not it's worth even talking to you about it. Because the first thing, we did a survey of all of our decision makers from all of the agencies and brands that we work with, and we had a huge response. It was almost a 90% response on all of them. And surprisingly, the question we asked them was, if you don't know anything about an event at all, and you're looking at it for the first time, what's the number one piece of relevant information that you want to know? I thought it was going to be information about the event, just general information about the event. And it wasn't. It was demographic information. They wanted audience data about it before they even cared about your event. So if you think about the introduction deck, think of it as this is a very brief description, almost like a sales brochure without the prices in it. Like, here's the great things about our event. Here's some opportunities that you can have. And here's the basic information that you'd probably find on your website, but you don't have to go look for the information. We put it right here for you in this really pretty package. And then you use it as a way to say, hey, is this event of interest to you? And can we talk about what your goals are? And that's really what the introduction deck is all about. It's not making any assumptions about that sponsor or that you even know what their goals are. Because what happens a lot with events, and especially mid to small, is they decide, they say, oh, well, this would be a great sponsor for this. And it might be, but you have no idea about, it might seem like, oh, we'll have Nike sponsor shoes because that seems logical to you, but you have no idea that what Nike may be targeting is, you know, their new sunglasses, or it might be important to them to do their hats or something like that. So if you go off and just send them something that's like for your, you'll be the charge of the shoe, you know, you'll be the sponsor of the shoes, and without even checking with them what they're all about. I mean, we have conversations all the time with brands, and we're like, oh, I had no idea that they're trying to go after this. Or it might be healthcare, but the healthcare is really interested in going after B2B healthcare, not necessarily individual healthcare. So things like that. So we do the introduction deck. Basically, the point of that is to basically ask these sponsors, do you have an interest in our event? Can we talk about our event? And for us, we have to send it to all the agencies. It's very important. They won't, most of them won't even talk to us until we send them this for all of our events. And we say, you know, does this one look like it works for you? Because some of them actually have to plug it all into a backend system to see if it even fits all their criteria. Because just as you and I were talking about mission statements and audiences and things like that, these brands are doing the same thing. So if your event and your audience doesn't fit into their target, then there's no point in having these conversations.
But beyond, I guess, the hard numbers, the audience, you know, the stuff that I definitely appreciate, corporates have a pipeline, they're going to put it into a system, they're going to do some pre-selection and stuff. I guess that deck also has to convey some of the soul and the excitement of the event, right? Why people love it. Basically, you want to tell them that that's my audience and my audience loves my event and you guys should be interested in getting on board.
You do. And you want to do it, though, I would say, in a concise manner. So yes, it is important. Like if your event has different accolades, if it's gotten press, if it has any kind of fun elements to it, photos sell. I always say that photos sell more than words a lot of times. So having great photos is really important. So yes, those things are important. Having all that stuff is super important. But I will tell you that in the beginning stages, especially when you're trying to work with regional and national sponsors, a lot of times they don't care about, like when I first, and poor Hood Dakota, I'm going to call them out on it again. But when I first started working with them, it was several years ago though, their little deck was like 2 pages of it was all about the history of the event. Well, it's really interesting stuff. But at that point in the game, when you're sending that out, they just don't care. I wish they did, but they don't, because they're going through so many people trying to go after it. So yes, you want to have those things. I mean, it's really important. You want to make sure you have all that information, but you want to make it super concise on how you want to do it. And like I had mentioned before, I'm happy to give you guys a link that you can download where you can actually get a workbook that would explain to you page by page what your deck should look like.
Yeah, that'd be great. We can put it in the show notes. So basically you're saying, just to recap that point, which I think is important, is that sort of the objective of this deck, the call to action, basically, because, you know, you're sending it out and you're asking for something, is you're going to be sending that deck to your sponsor prospects to basically invite them to have a chat with you about taking part and their objectives and all that.
Absolutely. Yes. You're using it as a way to say, would you be interested in this event? Let's have a conversation about it. You want to give them enough excitement where they want to talk to you about it, but you also don't want to give them so much information that they just shut you down without having that conversation with you.
Awesome. So that's a great segue then to actually start looking at the prospecting stage. So I've got my audience. I know who they are. I've got my intro deck on hold, ready to send out to the right people. Now, I want to find the right people. I want to match my audience with the right kinds of sponsors. And I was going through your book, and actually in that, you have a great list of little areas where you might look for a sponsor that might be suitable for your event. So little pockets of opportunity. So I want to go through all of them one by one, if we can. First one you say there, which is definitely one you want to check when you do a race, particularly a small local one, is you want to be looking at companies that are local to the race. And I guess we're talking there, we mentioned local car dealerships, really interesting target ground. I've seen lawyers, lots of like lawyers, family service type stuff get involved, some local supermarkets. What else comes to mind?
When it comes to the local community, sometimes the local running stores, sometimes the different coffee shops, things like that. When you're a smaller race too, in-kind can be very important to you. So some of those may be more in-kind trade. Looking at those local companies, and I say in there, think about what you use too. I mean, a little bit of self-identifying there, but do you use certain dry cleaners? Do you use, because when it comes to the local stuff, people tend to support those who support them. So if you are a customer, I mean, I tell people to go to the bank that your race uses and say, look, I'm a customer of yours. Can you support us? And a lot of times they'll do it. And depending on the event, and sometimes it may not be that much, but sometimes it can be a lot. And you may not need that much. I mean, $500 to $2,000 might be fine for you as a sponsor, depending on the size of your race. Those are really important. Those local ones like that, like you were saying, grocery, running stores. Sometimes even if you have a race, you might look at other outdoor activities because probably those that are running would also be interested in things that are other outside activities, things like that.
Yeah. And actually running stores, definitely one for the local sponsor bucket, but also a good fit for the second area you were suggesting there, which was companies that would be a good fit with a race. I guess what people call like endemic kind of sponsors. So like people who are relevant to running. You mentioned running stores, gyms, I guess, are a good one. They like to get involved with races. Physiotherapists, I see quite a lot, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the thing I'd mentioned too is that these pockets that we're talking about, this is a perfect brainstorming opportunity too. Like try to get your group together and do this together. And what I suggest in those is that you go through each of these groups and you each write down five that come to mind. And by the time you get done, if you have three or four people in the room, you're going to have a great list to start with that isn't just a random, I'm going to pull the Chamber of Commerce list. So yes, so those are great ones. You had it, you nailed it on there. The ones that are very obvious, protein or bars or Gatorades, things like that are going to be really, those are going to be the easy ones, that like the ones you see at every race or the ones that are natural fits for runners or those people around that lifestyle. So that's a super easy one. And then the other one was like companies or people that I know already. Like you start to say, okay, what are my contacts? Who are my contacts? And let's just write them down. Like people that I know would take my call and talk to me about the event. And when you're doing this brainstorm, write them all down, do it with everybody. And then you can weed through them later and say, okay, does this fit my mission? Does this fit my avatar? And go through it that way. But when you're trying to brainstorm and just start your list, just write, get them all down and think to yourself, okay, do I know this person? Do I know this person? Is there another avenue that maybe this doesn't make super amount of sense right now, but is there another way that I can tie this sponsor in some capacity, you know, things like that. So that's another one, because it's all about who you know and getting in there and those contacts.
Yeah, that's a great point about brainstorming, that's not a phase to hold back in. You want to dump everything on paper and you can go through and shortlist and prioritize after that. But you want to do a session where you just, anything that can come to mind that fits those categories, even remotely, you just put down, right?
Yes, absolutely.
I thought this was probably one of the most interesting points in this list, which is, obviously, sponsors need to be relevant, right? You don't want to make the mistake you were mentioning earlier that, you know, you just go for the money and you get anyone in. I guess within that circle of people who might be relevant and interested, or at least you think might be, we're going to talk about the reaching out phase in a sec, but you're going to have an easier time with people you know, or people that you know people know, right? So it's going to be an easier in into those companies.
Correct. And that's why including that in your brainstorm, you will realize that there's all these other people that know all these other, they all have their own contacts in some capacity as well. So that will really start to build out your contact list and your database, basically, is if you do it as a brainstorm and don't rely just on yourself it can be very helpful, even if you're just including some volunteers that are part of the race. Because I know sometimes people are doing those races all by themselves. I get that. But if you can involve some people that are part of that into some capacity, they could be like, oh, I know this person and they work at such and such grocery store or whatever.
Yeah, super important. I mean, networking generally, which I guess this would fall under, it's super important for putting on an event with very little stuff. You want to get as much information about who you can reach out to, even like, you know, someone, as you said, a volunteer or a participant knows someone in the local authority, right? Whatever. You want to have as many touch points of interest as you can across sponsors, participants, local communities, everything, right?
Absolutely.
Now, next bucket, also very important. I feel this is the lowest hanging fruit. It's companies that sponsor races similar to yours, right? I mean, no brainer, right? I mean, you'll ask yourself, how do you know a sponsor is interested? How do I know they would be interested in sponsoring stuff? Well, look at the 10K in the next town and see who sponsors that kind of thing, right?
Absolutely. I mean, and I tell, this is like the number one rule that I always tell everybody is that if you're looking for sponsors for an event, then go to events. Go check them out. Go see other races. And not only is it better, is it good for you as an event producer to see how other events do it? Because sometimes you can learn some fantastic things you didn't even think about. Also, you can learn what not to do. Not only that, but then you really get a good sense of who their sponsors are. Now, I mean, the one thing that all events are sort of notorious for doing is posting all their sponsors on their website. So, I mean, as easy as just looking at all these race websites, they'd show you who they all are. A lot of them sometimes are just the local sponsors, but then you think to yourself, oh, you know what? I never even thought of talking to a casino, or I never thought about the state lottery, you know, but if you can, they can even jog your ideas of like, oh, I should have, you know, I could look at that. Even if it's in a different state. So sometimes if you can't go to them, is to at least go through their website and see what that is. I mean, it almost gives me anxiety sometimes because I'm like, oh, great, we've posted all of our sponsors right up there. But that's what they want. You know, it is what it is. So it's a great tool. But not, you don't, if you have a race, then go look at other races. But it doesn't mean you can't also look at baseball games and other like sports related stuff, or maybe it's football or whatever it is. But checking those out too gives you a real good sense of also how they're incorporating those type of sponsors. And if you can do that in the same capacity, that's another way of looking at that too, because you might get somebody who's like a mortgage company and you're like, okay, well, how can I relate this in a unique way to the audience that's running? Because you don't really think of mortgages when you're running, but everybody running needs a mortgage, you know, or maybe they do. So looking at those also gives you ideas of other categories that you might not have thought of as well. But yes, you're right. Absolutely. The low hanging fruit.
Yeah. And you can't imagine how much you can learn almost instantly by just, as you say, observing who sponsors other events, how they're doing it. Can I get someone similar to that? It just jogs your thinking process.
Yes. Your creative juices for sure.
Now, last category you have there, also very important, a little bit, I guess, on the pragmatic front, is think of the needs you have. So there are certain things you need for your race. And here we're leaning a little bit more towards in-kind sponsorship. And you're thinking, okay, I need, you know, let's say I have a team, they're in location, I may need a hotel. I may need, you know, nutrition bars because I want to put them out anyway. I may need water bottles, right? All kinds of stuff.
Yeah, it could be any of that stuff. It could be porta potties. It could be timing. It could be any of that stuff. Maybe you have a concert at the end of your race. You need a stage or things like that. But yes, looking at all of those things and thinking to myself, okay, these are things that we need. Can we offset them with sponsorship in some capacity? And you don't necessarily have to go to the brand that would inherently provide those. So like maybe, you know, you need a stage. You don't necessarily have to go to the stage company and say, can you be a sponsor and give me a stage? What you can do is say, okay, we need a stage. So what I'm going to do is go to that mortgage company and say, hey, do you want to be the stage sponsor of this? You know, and they can help offset your costs, things like that. Or if you need water, you go to one of those water companies that actually services office buildings or something like that. And can we have some of your giant I don't even know what those are called. Containers of water.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so we had a company that needed water and I couldn't get a water because I will be really honest, water tends to be kind of a weird, it's hard to kind of get a water sponsor in your traditional sense because they want depletion. They want to get paid for, they want you to buy the bottles basically. So it's a little difficult and usually it's tied to your soda contracts and a lot of races don't have those. But what we have done in the past has been able to get water provided by something that may not traditionally be tied to water. So it, you know, it could, I think it like, maybe it's a doctor's office or something like that. And so we buy the water, but maybe it's labeled because of the doctor's office, or maybe you have water stations and they're branded like Liquid IV because Liquid IV is a hydration packet that goes in water, you know, things like that. So that's all very commonplace, but actually getting sponsored bottled water is actually very difficult, believe it or not, when it comes to like using a national brand. Now you can probably get somebody to go to like one of the big box stores and buy cheap water, but, or have it donated by a grocery store or something like that. But it's hard to get those big, like Aquafina's and those kind of things to actually pay for a sponsorship of water.
Yeah, I think there is a very interesting point there that's very pertinent to races, which is lately, you know, one of the big demands, additional demands that I guess are starting to emerge for races is sustainability, right? So people want to make their events greener and more sustainable, but there's a cost. And there's this emerging trend of sustainability sponsors, which runs along those lines, which is basically to say, let me go to a bank or let me go to someone who would benefit from being seen as supporting my sustainability effort as a race. And let me tell them, you know, you're going to give me $5,000 or something, and I'm going to use that money to make that race more sustainable. I'm going to get the more expensive water cups. I'm going to get all kinds of stuff that I'm going to improve my race footprint. But I don't go to the water cup people. I go to the bank who has the money and I tell them, you're going to be my sustainability sponsor.
Right. Exactly. And that's an excellent point. It's like, that's a way, when you look at what you need, it's a great way to put those sponsors that you can't seem to figure out how they're going to fit in there naturally into creating something that's more of an activation and something that engages with that racer than just a logo on a t-shirt or just a logo on a banner, because I'm highly against that. It's very hard to get those people to come back if you haven't done something where they're having this impact with those people. And when you make the runners' lives easier, when your brand has something to do with making it easier, like providing them with water or providing them with hydration or providing them with a sustainable race and some, then they relate to that sponsor in a totally different way than if they just see the logo on the back of a t-shirt.
And one last, I guess, sub branch of that, of the, you know, companies that can feel a need my race has kind of bucket, is also media companies, right? Local media companies that I see people don't think of immediately, because media companies can provide you with coverage. They can provide you with publicity, having like a radio sponsor, a local newspaper and stuff like that is also quite important. I mean, you don't pay for that, but it's a very great benefit to have, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. And I came from a 15-year career in radio before I moved into this. And it actually can be, depending on the market that you're in, it can actually be difficult to get free coverage or to get free promotion. So if you can work on that deal with those media companies ahead of time and get something like that, where they even provide you with so many promos, like maybe it's 200 promos or maybe it's 200 spots, things like that. If you have that stuff in place prior to, you can also use those as leverage for your sponsors. You can sell them in, you know, like you're going to get tagged on so many radio spots, or you're going to be included in this morning coverage or something like that. So knowing what your media partners are willing to provide you. And we've also had sponsors who will buy part of it. You know, you add onto it and you say to them, in your package, you're also going to get 2 weeks tied to radio spots. Then we take part of that sponsorship and go buy ourselves ads. And that helps, you know, market the event. And then the sponsor also gets part of that marketing budget. So knowing your partners is a huge, if you can do that prior to, it's a huge win for you. But I do know a lot of smaller events have a hard time getting that. But there's usually some local papers or local radio that would be, you know, interested in be involved in that. But some of those bigger markets, when you get to the bigger markets, it can be a little bit difficult to get those media partners involved without any kind of money towards them. But if you can also tie that into a sponsorship too, as well. So keep that in mind.
Let's move on to the next stage in this process. You've come up with your short list of sponsors. You know whom you want to contact. This is also a very tricky stage, I think. How do you find the right person to contact? How do I get their contact info, right? We're going to talk about what you tell them in a sec, but like, how do I even know whom to reach out to? What's your tips on that?
Okay, so I have 10 different ways that I tell people they can do it. And I'm going to start preface this with saying that as an agency, I've been doing this for over 20 years and there is no magical potion. I wish I could tell you that there's a hidden database that nobody knows about that you just type in and then you get the contact and that's what happens. There are a lot of those and I'll tell you about one of them in particular, but there is no like secret thing that nobody knows about. And this is sponsorships is our lifeblood. So part of what we do is we have to find these people as well. So I'm going to share with you some of our tips and how we do it when we're starting from scratch. Now we've been in business so long that we know most of the agencies now and they know us. And so it's a lot easier the more you do it. But when you're first starting out and you're like, well, how do I find those people? So a couple of things to keep in mind is the first one is obviously you always go to the company's website. That's the first thing you do. Check it out. Look at the very bottom, even those national ones. If you look at the very bottom, sometimes they'll have partnerships at the bottom or they'll have like contact us or they'll have like frequently asked questions, things like that. And some of that stuff will all be in there. The company's LinkedIn. LinkedIn has changed the game on some of that stuff. So even if you can go into LinkedIn and search for people that work for that company, sometimes you can get the names. And if you understand, like a real trick we do is if you can go on the website and figure out how their emails are structured, then when you go into LinkedIn, you use their name and then structure the email that way. So I know it seems a little tedious, but we do that game all the time. So that one. Another one now is to search companies' Facebook or other social medias, because a lot of them also have, they'll now mark who are leaders or who are part of that page. Sometimes, too, depending on the brand and who they are, if you message them through there, you don't do a pitch through any of these channels. But if you message them and say, who would I speak to if I want to talk to someone about partnering with a race, you know, something like that, don't give them a whole bunch of details. That's the other key, is I don't ever use the term sponsorship when I'm first engaging with people. I use partnership, because sometimes sponsorship sort of scares people off. But that's another thing is like, we've done that before where I've just reached out through their social media channels via message and said, I'm just trying to track down who the contact is. A lot of times don't write it on a board or anything like that, message them. But a lot of times that whoever's in charge of that, their whole job is just to forward info. So they will actually send you an email address. So that's another one. I always say Google the company. And then what I do is search press releases too. So if you Google the company and then type in sponsorship with it, a lot of times it'll pull up press releases or other information like that. And then it will tell you who the contact was. I found press releases with people's cell phone numbers on them. Now, I try not to use that, but that's another trick that we do. Also think about the contacts that you may have within a company. Like think about it. Look at your social media. I mean, I did this with our operations director, Justin. One time I was trying to track down a contact for a very large vehicle company. And he was getting frustrated because they were sponsoring everything and he couldn't track down the number. I was doing everything I could do. We finally tracked it down and lo and behold, I never knew this, but I was friends with the person on Facebook. And I didn't even think about it because I didn't know who they were, because I didn't really know them, but they were friends with one of my friends. So sometimes just take a look at your actual network and say, do I know anybody on here? Because some people have more people than others, you know, that they're friends with on social media, but I did not know, but she was actually connected to me on Facebook and we had spent so much time, which she was very frustrated with me on that one, but I didn't think about it. The other thing too is call the home office or a local branch. If you cannot find it, just pick up the phone and say, hey, I'm trying to get in touch with somebody to talk to them about partnerships, who would be the person I reach out to. 90% of the time, they're going to either send you to a voicemail or they'll send you an email address. Most likely now they send you an email address because it's just easier. Most companies are not just going to say, oh, we can't talk to anybody. They're going to give you somebody, but just don't launch into pitching them when you call them. Just find out, you know, who it would be. Or maybe you just walk in the door if it's like a phone company or something like that, or a Cricket Wireless or whatever. You might just walk in locally and say, hey, who would I talk to if I want to tell somebody? But what a lot of smaller events like to do is they just drop off that 4-page levels and don't actually have a conversation with anybody. And then whoever's behind the counter is like, oh, okay. You know, there's no actual engagement. Another one that we do use is we use a third-party application. There are several of them out there. We've probably used almost all of them that are specialized towards sponsorships. There's a lot of sales tools that you can use for B2B and things like that, but there aren't very many that specialize in sponsorships. And so we use the tool Winmo, and I can also give you a code that gives everybody a free, like 100 free leads. So they can get some free leads just for going in and looking at it. But it's a really massive database. It's probably the closest thing to the secret weapon. But I'm going to be honest, it's not inexpensive. It can be pricey. They do have nonprofit discounts and things like that. It also gives you all this up-to-date information about what brands are doing and what they're spending and what they're buying. And you kind of know it before it happens so that you can get it in your budget. Because sometimes what happens is by the time you see a big launch or you see it on television or you see it all over the place, they've already blown their budget. They've already spent it all because it was part of their big release. So keeping that in mind, that one does get you up to date. And that one is one where if you're looking for something in particular and you can't find it on there, they will search it for it. They'll find it for you. A human being will find it for you. There are some cheaper ones out there, but a lot of the times they're just based off of, they're not human verified. They're just basically like an algorithm that scours the internet for contacts. And it's a lot of what you can get already. It's just, it kind of saves you time, but they're not verified that those are the right contacts, where Winmo is verified, which is why you're kind of going to pay for it. But that's probably our favorite. That's the one I endorse when it comes to third-party ones. If you have a lot of events, it's probably worth the investment. If you have one, it might not be. Another one that which circles back to what you and I talked about is go to community networking events. Be a part of your chamber, be a part of your business alliance, be a part of those kinds of things, because that's what's going to help you. And if you know those people, or if you know somebody in a company there locally, they're more inclined to take your call or be like, oh, we met at such and such alliance or such and such networking dinner. They're going to be more inclined to take those calls and at least look at what you have to provide them. So that's a huge one. And then mutual contacts who might be willing to connect you. That's another thing, is look at those friends of yours that might be on social media, or those friends that maybe you see kind of remotely for work, and ask them to help, you know, connect you. So those are sort of our tips on how to find it. And that's what we actually use. Even as professional sponsorship seekers, I wish I could tell you that there, like I said, that there's some secret thing, but I think that those, if you follow those sort of protocols, you're going to have a lot more success for sure.
Yeah, I think these are awesome tips. I've taken a look at the tool you suggested. I think that probably makes sense for you guys as an agency. For your average race director, it is a bit pricey, as you say. I actually think that LinkedIn nowadays, as you say, is probably the closest thing you have to a secret weapon. Because even if you pay, you know, let's say you want to do all of this process, all your sponsor outreach within a month or two, right? I mean, you pay, the subscription is probably like 40, 50 bucks a month or something. And you get lots of more tools to enhance your search, and you can even like do cold outreach to people who are not your immediate connection. So LinkedIn, I think, is a great tool. The one question on that, which applies more generally but is important to LinkedIn, is what kind of title would you look for people within an organization who would give you better chances of hitting someone who may be the contact person for partnerships and sponsorships? What would their title say?
So a lot of them will be like partnership director. Sometimes they'll say sponsorship. A lot of times it's partnership. Sometimes it's event manager, or it'll be promotions and event. Sometimes it's field marketing is another one. I usually will kind of look in the marketing category, because that's usually when sponsorships falls into, is marketing. The one thing I will say is, depending on the company, you don't want to go too far up. You don't want to go so high up that it just is trash in their mailbox, you know? So I know some people think, well, I got the CEO. Well, the CEO of Sony is not going to answer your call, you know? So you want to find something that's more local to what you have. So maybe if you find partnerships for West Coast, if you're West Coast, or maybe it's partnerships for that area, but looking for marketing, field manager, partnerships, sponsorships, you know, those are sort of those key words. And I 100% agree with you on the LinkedIn thing. I would say I would be careful about pitching within a message, but I would definitely take a look at, you know, their email and maybe trying to send an email in that direction. To the effect of the Winmo is that you search it by their titles. And so you can pick out the marketing versus the sponsorship. So that is one of the other nice things about them, because that is a actual issue. Sometimes it's just trying to track down who the right person is within the company, which one is the right person. We stay away from CEOs. We stay away from COOs, things like that, CFOs. Like we're pretty much try and stay within the marketing field. And that's where we get PR sometimes, but honestly, PR is different than marketing. Most sponsorships come out of a marketing budget.
Did you know that in a recent survey, 73% of responders said that reading reviews influences which races they enter? Well, RaceCheck is the largest aggregator of race reviews in the world and has collected over 40,000 reviews for over 6,000 events globally. So, how can you collect more reviews for your event and make the most of them to increase your race registrations? Well, you can start by listening to our Power of Race Reviews podcast from September 20th last year. Plenty of tips there on growing your race reviews. And then visit organizers.racecheck.com. That's organizers with an S, .racecheck.com, to download your free RaceCheck review box so you can start showing all your race reviews on your website for an instant boost to your race's social proof and conversions. It really is a no-brainer, so go to organizers.racecheck.com, that's organizers with an S, .racecheck.com, and download your free RaceCheck review box today. Okay, let's get back to the episode. Let's now move into the scary bit, which is reaching out to people, which involves a lot of things using the word cold something, which people get very nervous about. Cold emailing, cold calling, all kinds of stuff, right?
Yeah. Nobody's like, I love this.
Yeah. I mean, there's some people who are like super extrovert or whatever, but no one likes rejection. And there's lots of rejection involved in this, as we'll see, right? So, which is also a great lesson for people. Don't get dissuaded. Everyone gets rejected, right? So let's look at this approach then. Let's assume you don't know, you know, you've identified the company, the contact person, you have your intro deck, you know your stuff, you know your audience, you know your sponsor, which is really important before you reach out. And then you want to make your approach, right? So I guess there's two common ways of doing that if you don't know that person. One is to call. And the other one is to cold email. Which one would you recommend? How do the two compare? Assuming you had both an email and a phone, what would you do? Would you pick up the phone or would you write an email as a first contact strategy?
So it has changed. When I first started in this, it was cold call. Now it's cold email. People are very sensitive about their time. And they feel almost intruded upon when you just call them randomly. And because let's be honest, a lot of people work off their cell phones. So we always do email. I mean, it's so funny because our agency has a lot of, we have like the last three generations that work there. So it's obvious that our older sector who came from the world of call and hit the pavement and walk into the store kind of thing are having to shift into the email world because that is really how it works. Sometimes it depends on the sponsor. I will be honest, my experience with when I'm dealing with dealerships, like car dealerships, I have to call them. I don't know why, but for some reason, the car dealerships, those I always have to call, always for some reason.
Because that's what they do, I guess, right? They're also very big into calling. That's their mode of communication.
Yeah, they might not just sit in front of the computer like some other jobs do too. I'm not really sure, but I think the last three dealership deals, like big deals that we did, were through phone. And surprisingly enough too, those were some really big deals on a cold call. And we never even met the person until after the deal was done. And I mean, we're talking like, I think we did one over a cold call for $70,000. And then there was one that was like a random one that the guy didn't respond to our emails or our calls for probably 4 or 5 reach outs. And then one day I randomly called and got him on the phone, and then he bought a sponsorship for $40,000. So it's just kind of a fluxing. I wish I could tell you that it's straightforward, but for the most part, I would say 90% of our people are through email. We do that first because we try to set up a time so that they will be in the right mindset. If they feel a little ambushed, then sometimes they kind of reject it, just like you would. Think about yourself and how you would respond to someone kind of calling you out of the. So if you do call cold call, the first thing I always ask is, you know, hi, John, this is Teresa from Hood to Coast. And I wanted to see if this was a good time, but I'd really love the chance to chat with you a little bit about our event and seeing if whether or not we would be a good partner. And I always say it that way too. And that kind of leads to one thing I was going to say about mindset when you're going through this is don't think about if you change the way you approach it and you think about this is a discovery call. This is a way that I'm going to find out not only if they are interested in us, but if we are interested in them. Like maybe it's not going to be a great fit. So having this conversation with them, you're just trying to approach them to see if, hey, could we work together? Can we approach this together? And you may say no just as much as they may say no. I mean, you may get off the phone and be like, that's probably not going to work for us. You know, that happens a lot for me. So there'll be times where I'm super excited going into a call and I get done and they're excited. And I'm like, I don't think that's going to be the best fit, or they're not willing to invest what is needed for this to be a great partnership. So thinking about it that way a little bit can also help relieve that anxiety that this is some sort of we're waiting for them to tell me no, because you may feel just the same way. But yes, so I would say that for us, we are finding now that the best success comes from us emailing and asking for a chance to have a call about the event and just seeing if we could partner and if it could reach goals, if we can, you know, if we have mutual goals in line, or if we can help them reach any of their, you know, marketing goals, that kind of thing.
Right. Because this initial call or email, even if you get someone on the line and they have a little bit of time, this is not the time to overwhelm them and get like tons out. This is not the discovery session itself. It's trying to book that discovery session.
Yes, exactly. It's trying to just say, hey, can we? And now sometimes keep in mind, and I always tell this people when they call, be prepared that it could turn into that call. Because that is like I said, with that one car dealership, that's what happened. I was calling to say, hey, have you gotten the emails? Is there any way we can set up a time? And it went from, well, I've got time right now. What are you thinking? If you're going to do that, just be prepared, have your questions in front of you and know what you're trying to get out of that call. And what you're trying to get out of that call is basically what is their goals. And I can go through some of the questions that you might want to ask in that. The goal at this point, though, initially on making that approach is you're trying to set up the discovery call. You're trying to set up a chance to understand what they're trying to get out of the sponsorship so that you can propose a sponsorship that's better for them. And I know it sounds a little bit like this is super long and tedious process. It really isn't once you kind of get into it and you sort of get into a cycle, but this is how you make really big money. This is how you go from doing, you know, $4,000, $2,000, $500, $2,000, you know, maybe $4,000 sponsorships for those mid ones to the 40, the 70, the 80, the 100,000, the Nike kinds of sponsorships, is because you're not going to get those with you sliding over, you know, gold, silver, and bronze packages. You are going to have to invest the time and the effort in order to get those big ones like this.
So on those first calls that you make and the first emails you send out, is the idea also to persuade that person to receive your intro deck as well? Would you even attach it to your cold email, I guess, to sponsors?
Yeah. So that's sort of a personal preference. Some people on my team, when they send the email, they'll attach the deck and basically say, you know, here's a little bit of information about our event. We would love to have the chance to chat with you to be a partner with it. We think that your brand is, you know, really great, would fit really nicely with our audience. And then they attach the deck. And then I tend to not attach mine. I tend to just send a couple sentence email and say, hey, we've got this event, and I'll have like a couple of like highlights that has like this many people and is a really great audience and that would fit your demographic, you know, things like that, or one best race ever or something like that. And I'd love to have a chance to talk to you about your brand partnering with this event. Would this be something you'd be interested in? I would be happy to send you more information. And I usually wait till they engage with me before I send the information. And the reason why I do that is because then if they come back and they say, yeah, I want more information, then I send it to them. And I said, and then I'll say this, you know, here's the info. I'd love to have a, you know, have a chat with you about it. And then usually at that point, we've sort of gotten a rapport going. And so that's why I don't usually attach it. But my other, but I do have other sales people on my team who do attach theirs, and it works for them as well. So I kind of think that's one of those things you just have to sort of play with. I usually wait. So that's my personal preference, but I don't think there's really a right or a wrong answer to that one.
Right. I think I'm probably with you on that, that maybe you want to get a little bit of buy-in before you sort of shoot that out, right? You want to get a little bit of someone on the hook a little bit before you send it out, so you know they're interested. You don't want to seem too presumptuous that, you know, you just throw a bunch of information to them. And one tip I would give people, actually, I don't know whether you guys do that. I do that quite a lot when I send out, you know, business presentations and other stuff, is put together your deck in a PDF or whatever, right? You strongly advise a PDF, but I don't actually send out the PDF. I keep it in my Google Drive and I send out the shared link to the PDF, because even if it's out, you can then sort of make some updates to the actual document and still the link would point to that and you can keep on updating it. Plus, you don't have to attach like a, you know, 2, 3, 4 meg file or something. And sometimes, you know, you get sent to junk or something because Gmail thinks you're sending something nasty.
Some of the corporate software on those really big brands, though, will fish out if you have links and you don't have, and they haven't you haven't had correspondence with them before. So that's the only reason why sometimes I would be careful on that. But I would agree with you. The other thing too is if you're going to do that with your links, then I would make sure that you open it up so that anybody with the link can open it. Because that's the other thing, is make sure your permissions are correct. Because a lot of times those get forwarded to other people to take a look at. So you just want to make sure that that's clear. But nowadays, it's pretty common to use links for stuff like that. So it's easier, but we did for a while, we struggled a little bit with the links. But you're absolutely right on the PDFs being, we'll sometimes have to resize ours twice down to make sure that it is small enough and easy to open, for sure. But I'm a big fan of PDFs, only because they look the same on every device. Where sometimes if you use like a Word or you use, you know, PowerPoint, or you're using Google Slides or whatever, they look different with different fonts and things like that in different capacities.
Yeah, you definitely don't. I mean, sending Word documents is completely archaic these days, right? I mean,
I know. I still get them.
Yeah. I think people should definitely think about sending out PDFs for this. One other aspect, I guess, in which calling people versus emailing people differ. And there's lots of differences. As you say, I think one point that you made earlier that I want to stress out for people was that when you cold email someone, you can ambush them in a way, right? The same way they can ambush you. And, you know, like they can get you straight into discovery and other stuff where you may not be prepared. So calling is a very, it's more of a high risk medium. I mean, you need to think on the fly. You need to be on your feet, right?
Mm-hmm. Feel confident in what you're doing. And sometimes I'll call, like if we've reached out maybe 4 or 5 times and we haven't heard anything, then I will call. And usually I'll just say, hey, I'm just checking in. I sent this email. And if you're not interested, it's totally fine. Just let me know. I just wanted to make sure you got it. So I'll do that. A lot of times I'll get sent a voicemail at the beginning of it. And then I leave a voicemail but the really interesting thing I will keep in mind, because this kind of brings up something that I want to point out to people is there's a book called The Science of Selling. And in it, people get discouraged within two to three emails. If they'll send one or two and then they don't hear anything, then they just call it quits. When it comes to something like this, we say don't give up until you hit like touch point 7. I know that sounds ridiculous, but a majority of our sales are done within 4 to 7 touch points, believe it or not. So if you don't get a response, follow up on the same email, you know, and the week later and just say, hey, I'm just checking in and, you know, wanted to see if you had any information, if you want any more information or have any questions, you know, that kind of thing. And don't quite give up, because actually a no is better than nothing. Because if you get a no, then you know you got the right person, put that in your contact, keep in touch with them, follow up with them each year, you know, that kind of thing. At about 7, if we don't hear anything from somebody at touch point 7, we retire the lead as maybe one that's not a valid lead. But don't be afraid. Don't give up because you didn't hear anything the first time or the second time around.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things I do when reaching out to clients or even like business partners and stuff like that, and, you know, I send them an email, they don't get back. Then, you know, like I follow up in a week, they don't get back, et cetera. You definitely see it if you keep insisting that, you know, someone may come back even like on your 6th email or 5 months later and they'll tell you something. But one thing I do that I find is very effective is after I send maybe a couple or 3 at the most saying, you know, like, hey, you know, just checking if you got this kind of thing. I actually, on my 3rd email or my 4th email, I would go, listen, it's okay if you're not interested, right? So just make people comfortable to say no to you, right? You prepare the ground. It's like, listen, it's perfectly fine you're not interested, but can you just tell me you're not interested? So I just close off, as you say, the lead on my CRM, right? But like, no hard feelings, just make me the courtesy to just say no. And it's that email where, you know, like where you put people on the spot a little bit, that someone who just reads your emails and doesn't have time to respond to something would actually stop and say, oh no, you know, listen, it's been hectic out here and I'm going to get back to you in a couple of weeks, but it's not that I'm not interested kind of thing. You want to put people a little bit on the spot.
Right. Just be careful to not come off too super aggressive about it. But yeah, I think you're right on that, because sometimes, like, I get that too, because sometimes I can't tell if they are automated. Because there are those automated CRMs, because I get those kind of emails all the time. And so I'm like, is this an automated CRM like email that just I got tagged into, or is this a person actually trying to reach out to me about something? So I think, and including something about their brand in it is also a really big thing. And the way you do your headline is also another way, like the way you do the subject line. And for us, we always say, like, we put the brand, we'll always put, like, let's say Nike and Hood to Coast. And that's what we put. We don't put like possible sponsorship or, you know, we just put the brand and then the event. And 90% of the time they open it just simply because they're trying to figure out what it's about. So that's something to do as well that helps get you some sort of at least open rates on that too.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to structure the subject line. We do it all the time as well. So last thing, so inextricably linked with all this, is rejection, of course. You're going to get tons of it, right? I mean, you need to grow a little bit of a thick skin on this. It's not personal, right?
No.
All kinds of reasons why you may be rejected.
Oh my gosh. And I can't tell you how many of them that were rejections for years that ended up becoming sponsors that we work with, that we end up working for years. I mean, sometimes you just have to find the right time. Or there are ones where they were interested and then they come back to us and say, hey, you remember that event? Do you guys still do it? So I just think of it as it's just not right now. No, for now, you know, is kind of how I think of it. And it actually doesn't bother me anymore. Like they're like at all. I never thought I'd get to the point, but I just, one of the guys on our team always says no is better than maybe, because at least then you know. And so, and every time we get a no, we know that we've got a contact and we put it into our database. You know, it's the ones that actually are more frustrating for me are the ones where they just don't respond at all, where you can't, because then you're like, did I even get to the right person? You know, that kind of thing. So the no's actually, for me, are a way better than, I mean, of course, yeses are the best, but the no's are at least, hey, we're engaging now. I can come back to you next year. You know, and the thing I always ask them when they say no is, you know, like usually they'll say, no, we're going to pass this year. And I'll say, well, I totally understand. Would you mind just giving me some insight on why you guys passed? And people forget to ask that, because if you ask that, then it could be, and don't use it as a way to change their mind. Use it as a way to reapproach them in the future. So like we were going after 5-Hour Energy at one point, which is that the energy supplement for a race. And they were like, you know, no, not for now. And I'm like, how could this supplement company that loves to sample would say no to Hood to Coast, which has like all these people? And, you know, we just couldn't fathom it. And they were like, well, we just don't do 1-day events. It's too pricey for us to do 1-day events. Well, that's not anything we can change. So, I mean, it wasn't about us. And so knowing those kinds of things about these different ones then can remind, and you make a little note and you save it. And then if any of your event ends up changing or you have other events, then maybe they're a better fit for another event. So asking them those things are really important, or it could be something you could fix. Maybe it's that you don't have enough information for them, or maybe your pricing is off, or, you know, those kinds of things. So ask them. If they say no, feel free to, in the most respectful way possible, just be like, can I ask for some feedback on why there was a no, just so that we know I can take it back to the team and we know better.
Speaking of pricing, it's not something I that you'd advise that you go into in that call, but what if a sponsor prospect asks you straight away, you know, like some people are very kind of like money focused, what's this going to cost me? Even if they don't have the patience to go through the process that is the right process, what if you hit someone on the phone and they're like, what kind of money are we talking about? Is that something you'd go into, or would you gently try to wiggle out of it at that point? Because you just wouldn't know enough about it.
So that does happen sometimes. Usually when they're that hardcore about it, they're not genuinely interested. Or they're trying to gauge whether or not that your event fits in their budget. So normally what will happen is I say, well, all of our sponsorships are custom. So it's based off of what kind of assets or what kind of activations you need to, you know, fulfill your goal. And we make sure that everybody is taken care of to their marketing goals. And then I say, I could say like our sponsorships range anywhere from, like I have some events and where I'm like, the cheapest sponsorship is $10,000. And so I would say like our cheapest sponsorship is a 10x10 booth and it's $10,000. And then it increases from there. And the thing is, if that's the case for your event, then go ahead and be straight up with it, because you don't want to waste your time. If they can't do $10,000, there's no point in trying to do a whole sales pitch if they can't do that. Now, if your event is smaller and you can say, well, you know, a basic booth starts around $2,000 or $500, something like that, then that's totally fine too. So have an understanding of what you're willing to do. Like, what is the minimum you're willing to take for a sponsorship? You really need to understand that about your event, because that way, you know, like, it's not worth my time, effort, or my volunteers' time if it's less than, you know, $1,000 or $500 or $250 or whatever, depending on whatever your event size is. So once you understand that, then when they ask you that, you can say it's, you know, they start at this price and they go all the way up to, you know, $20,000 or something like that. But I always say ours are all custom. And once we have a better understanding of what it is that you're looking for, then we can put something together for you and give you a couple of options. And I always give options too. I always do at least 2 or 3 different types of sponsorships, because that's another science of selling sort of thing, that the human nature tends to pick one if there's three. So it's kind of an interesting thing to know about it, is even if you don't really have three options, stick one in there, because they tend to pick one if there's three options. So I don't know why that is, but it's true.
It is. It's a very common thing. That's why you also see on like pricing pages and stuff for stuff, you know, there's always three options for some reason.
So even if you know that they want a 10 by 10 booth, so put a 10 by 10 booth in there and then put another one that's maybe like a race bib sponsor or something, and then like a presenting sponsor, just to give them the option of choosing. That's a very common sales practice.
Yeah. Usually what they say is that, yeah, you put a really stupidly expensive option that you know they're not going to take, just to have one there. So they feel like they're getting a bargain when they go with a middle ground or something like that, right?
Yeah, something like that.
It's completely silly sometimes how psychology works.
Yeah.
Listen, I really wanted to go into the next stage, which is the discovery meeting. And there's a few stages after that. But I'm really hoping after such a very fruitful discussion full of tips, maybe you do all of us the honor and come back on the podcast in the future.
I would love to do that.
And we go into that in a separate episode, because we're close to like a couple of hours now. I guess we'll edit it down a little bit. But
I know.
But it's know. We've been chatting for a while, which is awesome. I think this is one of those episodes that we've had so many tips, like, so, you know, we actually went through the actual call kind of thing, right? So we're,
yeah,
so many practical things that I hope people will find puts them in the shoe of, you know, like a real sponsorship process. Before we sign off, and hopefully, as I said, we'll see you again on the podcast, but before we do that, tell people a little bit about how they can get in touch with you. Maybe, you know, if they're considering some of that consulting advice that you offer, the book, other stuff that you do. So how can they reach out?
Yeah. So the easiest way, of course, is our website, which is greencactusca, like as in California.com. So GRENCACTUSCA.com. That's our website. It has a whole bunch of different resources on it, and freebies, things like that. You can get the workbook download. You can actually get the discovery call questions. That kind of stuff is on there. All the information for the book is on there as well, but you can also buy the book, which is Sell Your Event, the easy to follow practical guide to getting sponsorships. And that's at Amazon, of course, and Barnes & Noble. And then it has a companion workbook. And quite honestly, I'm really proud of that workbook. It goes along with the actual book, but it goes page by page, step by step. A lot of what we've talked about has an amazing amount of templates. So you don't have to actually recreate the process. You can just download the template and reuse them. It's got the questions. It's got the surveys that we talked about. Like, they're already done for you. So a lot of information there, and it's only $20. I always tell people there's even an agreement in there that cost me about $1,500, $2,000 to get made by my lawyer, and where it's in the $20 workbook. So that's available as well. And you can get that again at greencactusca.com. The book, though, can be purchased at Amazon or Barnes and Noble. And then my social channels are all Teresa Stass. So I'm on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. Feel free to follow me. I do a lot of speaking, so hopefully I will see some people out and about. And that's basically it.
You sent me some stuff before this for like research purposes. And I've seen you have tons of templates and stuff in the book. Like, you know, we were talking about prospecting, putting all the prospect sponsors in buckets and stuff. It's going to be really helpful for people. And I really hope that people consider reaching out to you, because, you know, God knows we all need a little bit of education in things like sponsorship and marketing and other stuff. And as I said, I hope we'll see you back on the podcast sometime soon to go through the rest of this process.
I would love to.
I want to thank you again very, very much for making the time so early in the day and a couple of hours of it as well.
Of course. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you to everyone listening in. And we'll see you all on our next podcast. I hope you enjoyed today's episode on finding and approaching sponsors with Green Cactus CEO, Teresa Stass. If you like today's episode, we've got a couple more great podcasts on sponsorship for you. So make sure to check out episode 35 of the podcast on the Sponsorship Seeker's Mindset with the amazing Kim Skildum-Reed, and our very popular episode 10 on selling sponsorships with Lifetime Events' Ben Pickle. Besides that, you can find more resources on anything and everything related to race directing on our website, racedirectorshq.com. You can also share your questions about sponsorship or anything else in our Facebook group, Race Directors Hub. Many thanks again to our awesome podcast sponsors, Run Sign Up and RaceCheck, for sponsoring today's episode. And if you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe on your favorite player and do check out our podcast back catalog for more great content like this. Until our next episode, take care and keep putting on amazing races.